Welcome to California Now, a podcast produced by Visit California. I'm Soterios Johnson. Are you ready to have some fun? This episode is all about celebrating the many reasons why California is such a great place to play.
Find your ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
That was a clip from Visit California's latest TV commercial, Let's Play. The ad does a great job of showcasing the many ways to play in the Golden State. We're going to continue that conversation in this episode, highlighting more activities and experiences that'll put a smile on your face. We'll start off with National Geographic Editor-at-Large Andrew Nelson. He'll explain why California plays a huge role in our favorite new travel trend, the destination duplicate.
The Central Coast has got the same sort of rolling landscape that Tuscany has. The hills are dotted with vineyards. What could be more Tuscan than that?
After that, we'll discover unique and wonderful wine country experiences with Jordan Kivelstadt, owner of the Bohemian Highway Travel Company. And then we'll wrap things up with a discussion about the most cheerful way to enjoy a cocktail. That's right, we're going to go deep on a classic California institution, the Tiki Bar. That's all coming up on California Now. My first guest has crisscrossed the globe for years in search of unique travel adventures and hidden gems. National Geographic Editor-at-Large Andrew Nelson says he's found quite a few of them in California. In his latest book, Here Not There, he highlights several California hotspots that rival some of the world's most famous destinations. Andrew, welcome to California Now.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to talking about California. It is indeed the Golden State in so many ways.
Absolutely. So, you know, I wanted to start out by talking about one of the year's biggest travel trends, and it's at the heart of your new book, Here Not There, the concept of the destination duplicate or destination dupe. So tell us about that. What is a destination dupe?
I'd be glad to. Destination dupes are exactly what it says. They are duplicates of a popular destination, which may be at this point very crowded, very expensive. And a dupe or a duplicate is a destination that a lot of travel experts have been identifying as having or containing the same sorts of attractions that you find in the more well-known destination. But at this destination, they're either less crowded or less expensive or less known. So you get a little of those bragging rights by going there.
Can you give us kind of an example of a popular destination dupe right now?
Instead of going to the Riviera, you might decide to go to Santa Barbara in California because it has the same vibe. It's a very upscale destination full of beautiful architecture with a Mediterranean joie de vivre and has many great wines from the surrounding areas, just like, say, the Côte d'Azur, as well as that beautiful sun and the beautiful views of the ocean.
So, you know, why are destination dupes so hot right now in the travel space?
Well, I think it's because post-pandemic, we had a tremendous upsurge in travel to the iconic destinations that we all know about, from Paris to Italy to Nashville, Tennessee, for example. And the problem has been is that these places have become more crowded and they are probably more expensive thanks to inflation. So that what dupes attempt to do is to give you or provide for you the same sort of experience. Of course, it's a little different, but with fewer crowds and hopefully a lower price tag.
Right. I mean, in your book, Here Not There, you highlight more than 100 different destination dupes that can offer world-class experiences. 9 of them are in California. What is it about California that makes it such a fertile ground for destination dupes?
I'm glad you asked, because California, as we all know, is such a diverse state. It has so many different geographical features, so many different lively and vibrant cities of all sizes, as well as range of parks, from state parks to national parks, deserts and mountains and sea coasts. It's pretty amazing. So you're really talking about a big chunk of the western part of the western coast of the United States. So it's all in California. So it seems only natural that so many of these destinations can be found there.
Right, right. So let's dive into some of those, starting with California's central coast. I mean, why do you think that region is a stand-in for the Italian countryside?
Well, the central coast has got the same sort of rolling landscape that Tuscany has. Plus, of course, it's got two wine regions, the San Luis Obispo wine region and the Paso Robles wine region. So the hills are dotted with vineyards. What could be more Tuscan than that, I ask you?
Hearst Castle is kind of like a Tuscan villa on steroids, right?
Absolutely. You know, they do things big in California, and that even includes villas. So William Randolph Hearst's Hearst Castle, or San Simeon, was one of those, which is filled full of architectural elements imported from places like Italy and France. So it is a wonderful place to sop up an old world feeling.
Oh, yeah. You definitely feel transported when you're there. Like, you don't feel like you're in America. What about the Channel Islands? You say they're a great stand-in for the Galapagos, right?
I guess let me qualify that by saying I'm not telling people not to go to the Galapagos, because of course people will want to go to the Galapagos. However, the price of going has gotten so expensive. Ecuador, who owns the Galapagos, have essentially have limited the amount of people that are allowed to go there for the very good reason that, you know, places that can suffer from over-tourism, it can impact the environment. So if you can't get to the Galapagos, the Channel Islands offer a reasonable facsimile because they are off the coast of Santa Barbara and they have been islands since the last ice age, because they were connected originally to the mainland, which allowed animals to flourish there. But when the water came back, they became islands which trapped on their islands. Like the Galapagos, animals evolved. So, for example, three mammals are now classified as subspecies of their mainland cousins, because over the thousands of years, they've evolved into something a little bit different. The foxes, which are terrible thieves, they will steal your, rummage through your backpacks. And then some of the mice. And then there are rare mammals that are found there in and are protected because this is a national park. So you have, for example, on Santa Rosa and San Miguel, you have pinnipeds like those giant elephant seals, which are my favorites, and northern fur seals. So, of course, you can go for, on a day trip. You can walk around some of the islands and then come back. It's a marvelous way to experience a different environment.
All right, let's look at Anza-Borrego Desert State Park next. I mean, you say it's a hidden gem that can substitute for a trip to Death Valley National Park.
Yes, you know, it's very easy. If you want to make a long day, you can start out from your hotel in San Diego and drive to Anza-Borrego and tramp around the desert, which has a very end of days feel, and be in this totally alien, totally beautiful, I think, environment, if you like the desert, which I do, I love the desert, and then be back at your hotel having and enjoying your wine by early evening. It is the largest state park in the United States. It's 650,000 acres.
Amazing. Bigger than some national parks, right?
Than some national parks, yes. One of the places which I find so inspiring and so eerie, it feels like a cross between the old Planet of the Apes movie and probably a Martian rover, which is called Fonts Point. And what you're looking out on is a series of eroded canyons that seem to stretch for miles. It's so impressive. And unfortunately, you will need a four-wheel drive to get out there. All I can say, it's otherworldly to be staring out at these sort of ravines and twisted canyons. And it just either sends the hair on your neck up, or you're just inspired.
Absolutely. When I visited Anza Borrego, I did some really amazing stargazing at night with a guide, and that was really cool. But I know during the springtime, there's a big draw that can be pretty amazing to watch, and that's the super bloom. Let's talk about that.
Absolutely. The super blooms are amazing. It's as if the entire desert got turned into a technicolor dream. Somebody has waved a wand and up come acres of gorgeous blooms.
In your book, you also specifically mentioned bighorn sheep as a must-see at Anza Borrego. Tell us more about the sheep.
One of the things that's so interesting about Anza Borrego is that it is a sanctuary for the bighorn sheep, which are an endangered mammal. And it's one of the last redoubts for them. They once ranged all across the West. What's so interesting is that in the summer, you can join an annual bighorn sheep census. And it's one of the country's longest running volunteer wildlife censuses and counts. You have to brave some very hot temperatures. It's not for the faint of heart or those who get worried about being in the sun, but it's taken about 50, they've been doing this for about 50 years to tally the health and the population of the animals in Anza Borrego. And so the last figures we have, they counted 300 individual bighorn sheep there.
Okay, let's do a few more destination dupes. In Here, Not There, you say Lassen Volcanic National Park is a great alternative to Yellowstone National Park. What makes it so great?
Well, first of all, what I always say about dupes is if you ever want to figure out where you might want to go in our national park system, look at the visitation. So Lassen National Park is full of hydrothermic activity, mud pots and geysers and bubbling, steaming, cracking, sulfur-smelling earth, you know, right at the primal part of the world's creation, it seems. It is 4 hours from San Francisco, and it only gets about 400,000 visitors a year. Yellowstone, can you guess how many they get?
Oh, I would say probably more than a million.
4.8 million.
Yeah, I was going to say millions, but I didn't want to overshoot.
Yes, yeah. So you can imagine how crowded Yellowstone can get. Lassen, because it is so close to San Francisco in terms of, you know, drive time, yet it has this wonderful primal landscape. What you see is the same thing that you will see at Yellowstone, except, of course, for far fewer tourists.
Right, amazing. You say Palm Springs is a great place to go in lieu of Hollywood, that you can kind of get a lot of the glitz and glamour of La La Land right in the desert. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, again, we're talking about the desert, one of my favorites. And I have to say, of course, people are going to go to Hollywood. That's famous. You want to see those stars. What Palm Springs has is that glamour still that we associate with the old Rat Pack version of Hollywood, where, you know, there were people like Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra and Angie Dickinson wearing Ray-Bans, hanging out in convertibles and generally enjoying cocktails and listening to bossa nova. That vibe still goes on in Palm Springs. And it is a wonderful place. If you want to ever feel like a glamorous movie star from the 70s and the 60s, you can just go to a hotel like the Colony Palms or the Herman Bungalows and hang out by the pool. These are all very pool-centric properties. Most of Palm Springs has a pool culture, so you can hang out and just feel like a movie star.
That's really cool. And again, not too far from a major city. I mean, if you're staying in LA, I mean, Palm Springs is a drive away, right?
It's a drive away. And, you know, if you don't want to avoid the traffic, go midweek.
You know, Andrew, we've talked about all these places in the Golden State that resemble other hotspots around the world, but you've traveled the state extensively. Can you talk about some of the places in California that you've found to be truly unique?
Without a doubt, one of the most unique places in the world, and that's why everybody loves it, is San Francisco. I can't imagine a more diverse, more beautiful setting for a city anywhere. Cape Town comes close, but San Francisco, the way it looks, you know, people always say you leave your heart in San Francisco. It's really kind of true when you're up there in the Marin headlands, looking down on the Golden Gate and across to the city. It's one of the views that can't be replicated anywhere. Truly unique. Another place that's been truly unique to me has been Bubblegum Alley in San Luis Obispo. Bubblegum Alley is an alley that leads off the main street of downtown San Luis Obispo, and it began by people just putting their gum on the old bricks. More and more people did it, and then, of course, word of mouth got out. So more and more people did it. So at the end, Bubblegum Alley is a little alley covered with gum on all sides. Kids love it.
Oh, that's funny. I'm sure like over the years, it gets a little narrower and a little narrower.
Yeah. Again, it's this kind of marvelous California attitude, which I think is both literally hands-on and do it yourself. You can leave your mark in California. And of course, you know, Yosemite. How can we forget Yosemite? It is spectacular. I can't think of any park that comes as close to as being so inspiring. It's, again, one of those things that people from all over the world come to, and they should.
Andrew, this has been amazing. Thank you for joining us on California Now.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing all of you when I'm out there.
Andrew Nelson is a freelance travel journalist and editor-at-large for National Geographic. To follow his travel adventures and learn more about his new book, Here, Not There, follow him on Instagram at Andrew Tyrrell Nelson. That's Andrew, T-Y-R-R-E-L-L, Nelson. This is California Now. You could describe my next guest as a winemaker. You could also describe him as a tour guide, beverage entrepreneur, and investor. Jordan Kivelstadt is the founder of Bohemian Highway Travel Company, a tour operator that takes guests to some of the best wineries in Sonoma County and the Napa Valley. Jordan, welcome to California Now.
Hey, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So let's get right into it. I mean, I love the name of your company, Bohemian Highway Travel Company. What's the mission statement? Why did you create it?
Well, the idea behind Bohemian Highway was to give guests visiting wine country the authentic wine country experience. And to me, I love where I live, and there's nothing better than taking people to the secret gems that define wine country.
Where did the name come from, Bohemian Highway Company?
I'm not sure a lot of people know, but the Bohemian Highway is actually a stretch of Route 1 in Sonoma County, and it's affectionately called the Bohemian Highway because the Bohemian Grove, which is a very famous collection where artists come every summer, is there. And it's emblematic of old Sonoma County, and we really thought it was emblematic of bringing people to the authentic Sonoma.
Right. You know, Sonoma County and Napa Valley are these two wine regions. They share a border, but they're not identical. So like at a high level, how would you characterize the differences between the two?
Well, I always like to joke they're sort of like Boston and New York, the Red Sox and the Yankees. We're rivals, but everybody has friends in both places. The way I view it is Napa is one famous for Bordeaux varietals, Cabernet, Cabernet blends, things like that. Sonoma is much more well known for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. In addition to that, Napa is more fancy. The wines are higher priced. It's a different experience, a little bit more curated, a little bit higher end. Sonoma's a little bit more rustic, a little bit more approachable, and the wines are a little bit more affordable. There are wines that are expensive in Sonoma and less expensive in Napa, but as a general rule of thumb, that's a good summary.
I mean, let's say I'm coming to Sonoma County and I want to taste some amazing wine. I call the phone number on your website, and then what?
So when someone calls, they get introduced to one of our concierges. These are locals who live in Sonoma and Napa, have been in the wine industry for a long time, and they'll ask you a bunch of questions. What do you like to drink? What wine do you open on a Thursday night? How many times have you been to wine country? What's the goal of your trip? Are you just out here to have a good time? Are you trying to find wines to add to your cellar? Are you trying to expand your wine knowledge? You know, there's a lot of things that we can learn. And since every tour we make is bespoke, is really customized to each guest, it's all about pairing the right guest with the right winery.
I imagine there's a wide range of people who come to you for these curated wine tours. Can you kind of give us a sense of your clientele?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, we'll have couples in their late 20s or early 30s that it's their first time to wine country, and their wine knowledge is pretty limited, but they're really excited to learn more. And then we'll have three couples in their 50s that are empty nesters that are coming out that have cellars and have been drinking wine for 30 years, and they want to go find the coolest cab house that no one's ever heard of. So when they go back to Ohio, they're going to open these incredible wines with friends. So it's a really diverse set. And then the cool one we actually introduced this year was our Sonoma Coast experience. And one of the things that broke my heart being a local here was how many people came to wine country and never drove 45 minutes out to the coast. The Sonoma coastline is spectacular, and we have some of the best creameries in the world. So we've seen that tour really appeal to families, and that's been really cool to see.
Let's go through some like scenarios. Let's say I'm a wine newbie. I like Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but I don't really know any specific wineries, and I'm traveling to the area because I want to learn more. Is that enough to start your wheels turning?
Absolutely. Because to me, I'm going to send you to two different types of experiences. The first experience is going to be what I say, kicking the dirt. I'm going to get you out in a vineyard on an ATV with a winemaker, hearing about the process, learning why grapes grow here, what the process of harvest is, all the way to the bottle. That's a great foundational education for a new consumer. And then in the afternoon, I'm going to take you to a fancier winery for a winery tour, and possibly sitting in a cave or on a gorgeous patio and drinking wines that are maybe a little higher priced, and giving you that range of experience to understand that wine country has diversity and you can learn from all of it.
That's really great. All right, let's try another hypothetical. Let's say I love Cabernet Sauvignon. I have a cellar full of Opus 1, Stag's Leap, and Camus. What does that tell you about me? And based on that, where might you take me?
So that's a great question. And I would actually respond with a question. Is your goal to collect more cult wines, or is your goal for me to take you to the best Cabernet house you've never heard of? Some guests want to go to well-known wineries and may even come to me with a list of specific wineries they would like to go to. That's fine. We have no problem. That's the guest preference. The majority of the time that a guest who has a cellar like that calls Bohemian, they're actually looking for the hidden gems. All of their friends have Camus and Schaefer and Opus One in their cellars. They want to come out here and find those hidden gems. So when they go home and pop a bottle, their friends say, "This wine is amazing. How did you find out about this?"
That would be my response. It's like, I want to go to the cab house that no one's ever heard of, that hidden gem. So where would you take me?
One of the places that we love is called Hill of Tara. It's an incredible small production wine. The winemaker and owner is the general manager of one of the most cult Cabernet houses in Napa. And this is his own private brand. The wines are incredible. They come from one of the greatest vineyards in Sonoma. And you sit in a private little hidden speakeasy, basically, and taste wines with the owner winemaker. There's one experience that we have called the Church Vineyard. And we're one of only three tour companies that has access to this property. And the whole experience happens in a church that was built in 1883 in Pennsylvania, and was taken down board by board and transported to California and rebuilt in the middle of a vineyard. And it's this incredible experience, both the wine and food, but also the surroundings. It feels so romantic and off the beaten path. I mean, people just go crazy for it.
That sounds amazing. Are there other sorts of requests that come your way? I mean, I'd love to hear about some recent tours, maybe to give listeners a sense of what's possible.
We had a great request recently. So a young man called and said, "I want to propose to my girlfriend on your tour." And we said, "That's amazing. And he was very specific about the location and ambiance and feel for what he was looking for. So we literally had pictures sent in from the wineries of specific locations at different properties where he could do it. He picked this one winery that we work with that has this terrace in their vineyard. It's very private. And then he said, okay, the second piece is my soon-to-be fiance loves cows. I want to pet a baby cow. This had to be part of the day.
Oh, wow.
Through our coast tours, we work with a bunch of the creameries out in the West Sonoma County area. And so we called one of them and we actually, they did the proposal and then we drove out to a creamery and she got to pet a baby cow and eat some cheese. And so it was incredible to be able to build this day that was perfect for them. And that's what we love doing.
That's pretty amazing. Talk about a customized tour. Let's talk about food for a minute. I mean, what if I really wanted to pair wine with really great food?
To me, wine and food are symbiotic. For a lot of people, they've never really had the opportunity to be educated on food and wine together and how symbiotic they can be. So it's an amazing opportunity to continue that education. So a number of our wineries have either bites paired with their wines, or we can offer full tasting experiences where you're doing a paired meal at a winery. Or what I actually love is to take a break from quote unquote wine tasting in the middle of the day, and we'll take the guests to an amazing local restaurant and they can sit and order and sort of take a break from the tasting experiences and get some amazing food.
Right, right. Absolutely. What can you tell us about your tour guides? I know you mentioned that they are locals. They live in the area. I'm guessing they really need to know their stuff.
Absolutely. We call ours hosts because they're locals. They know a lot about wine. They know about where we live. And they make your experience in the car, or the truck, I should say, a lot more than just getting from point A to point B. They educate you on viticulture, on winemaking, on the best restaurants to eat at. It's really about a conversation at that point, not just a driver. So finding those people, making sure that they have the knowledge and continuing to build it as they work with us is hugely important to us.
I mean, if you could give one piece of advice to someone planning a trip to wine country, what would it be?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say, one, we talked about going to the coast. If you have the time, please go to the coast. But most importantly, don't go to the wineries that you buy in your supermarket. Now, if it's your favorite winery and you love those wines, go. But I think the value of coming to wine country is to go explore all the places you've never heard of and discover a new favorite. So to me, that's probably the most important element to your trip out to wine country.
Right. Expand your horizons. It's great that you know what you love, but there might be something out there that you don't know that you might fall in love with. How do you feel about, I mean, do you have any strong feelings about the best base camp for a wine country trip? Like, are there certain towns that are just maybe ideally situated to, you know, serve as a base camp?
Absolutely. I have strong preferences on this one. I love the Sonoma side. I find the towns to be really charming. I like places with a square, because there's something wonderful about walking around these small town squares and the energy and the atmosphere. So for me, my favorite places to stay are Healdsburg, Sonoma Valley, and if you're going to be on the Napa side, St. Helena or Yountville.
All right, let's talk about restaurants. I'm sure you get asked about them all the time. What do you say when guests are looking for recommendations? Like maybe they want to go out on their own for an evening.
Absolutely. And we have a list of recommendations to provide to any of our guests, our favorites. But that again comes back to asking them what they're looking for. Are they looking for classic European? Are they looking for something more avant-garde California? Are they looking for a Michelin star experience or a rustic backyard experience? You know, again, every customer wants something different. Napa tends to lean more toward the Michelin star multi-course experience. Healdsburg has a bunch of that as well. Sonoma Valley tends to be a little bit more rustic country European influence, but there are literally phenomenal restaurants sprinkled all over Sonoma and Napa. And eating here is one of the great joys. Well, drinking and eating.
Well, okay. So say I wanted that rustic backyard experience. Where would you send me?
I mentioned the one Bloom Carneros earlier. That's one of our favorites for that beautiful seasonal backyard experience. That's also great. Glen Ellen Star up in Glen Ellen. And then as you get up to like Barn Diva up in Healdsburg, all of those have that fresh seasonal component to what they do that I really enjoy.
Say I wanted to do like a European cuisine Michelin starred restaurant.
That's an interesting combination. I would push people towards the Napa side, somewhere like Bottega, which is really beautifully executed Italian cuisine in that Michelin environment.
You know, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you a non-wine question.
Answer those.
What else do you do for fun in wine country? I mean, do you have any insider tips for non-wine activities?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you asked because there's so much to do here. So one, hiking. We have some of the most spectacular hiking. Jack London State Park, where the author, his ranch, is an incredible place to hike. You can actually see his ranch where he wrote a bunch of books. You can get up north and out towards the coast and take these incredible hikes along the coast looking out over the ocean. There's phenomenal mountain biking. There's good fishing. And there's phenomenal biking as well. If you're a road cyclist, we have some of the best climbs and some of the best cycling in the country.
What's your favorite thing to do?
My favorite thing to do is, well, I wish I spent more time outside. We love to hike and we love to eat. One of the great things about wine country is the community. It's a small community. People all really look out for each other because our business, our lives, and our community are all sort of intertwined. And so there are so many amazing community activities that happen throughout the year that the whole community comes out for. So let me give you a good example. If you're coming to wine country during the mid spring to late fall, and you're in Sonoma, stay through Tuesday night. There's the Tuesday night farmers market on the square in downtown Sonoma. And literally the entire town comes out. There's live music, there's food trucks. It's not what you think of as a quote unquote farmers market. It is this like thriving, energetic, fun place. And when I tell guests this and they stay, that will often cite that as the best part of their whole trip.
Absolutely. You know, Jordan, this has really been a blast. I feel like I kicked my wine expertise up a notch here today and also got some really great insight. So thank you so much for joining us on California Now.
Really happy to do it. I really appreciate you guys having me.
Jordan Kivelstad is a winemaker and the owner of the Bohemian Highway Travel Company. To learn more about booking a tour, visit bohohighway.com. That's BOHOHWY.com. This is California Now. Did you know the concept of the tiki bar was invented in California in the 1930s? My next guest is a driving force behind a resurgence of tiki culture in California and beyond. Martin Cate is the owner of the popular tiki bar Smuggler's Cove in San Francisco, and he knows how to make a memorable cocktail, especially with rum. Martin, welcome to California Now.
Thanks, Atiri. It's great to be here.
So, you know, when I imagine tiki, I think giant, brightly colored, fruity drinks, probably with little umbrellas. But there's a lot more to it, right? What exactly is tiki?
So this whole thing really begins, as you said, in California in the 1930s, in earnest around 1934. And I say in earnest because it started with one person, a man named Ernest Raymond Beaumont Gant, but was something of kind of a roguish character who collected flotsam and jetsam from all over the world. And he was able to get a little vacated tailor's shop inside a hotel on North McCadden Place, just off of Hollywood Boulevard. and he hung up all of his flotsam and jetsam, and he christened it Don's Beachcomber Cafe. It was really something that nobody had ever seen before. It was a space that was kind of an imaginary hut in an imaginary place. It was a sort of a ramshackle little hangout at a time when people were still enjoying, at least people with some money during the Great Depression, were enjoying spaces like the Coconut Grove at the Ambassador Hotel and things like that, that were, you know, a night out was a bit more formal. It was a black tie, big bands, things like that. It was a space where it was just kind of a wild experiential setting that people weren't used to. And it became a sensation overnight, absolutely packed to the gills with stars. Greta Garbo, Howard Hughes, Charlie Chaplin, everybody hung out there. The place, he ended up having to expand and moved across the street. And he changed the name to Don the Beachcomber. And he changed his name as well to Don Beach. And it kicked off what became a decades-long fad that encompassed much more than the drinks, although the drinks are important. It became a full-fledged art, design, architectural movement, really. There's really sort of nothing else like it.
Let's talk about a few well-known tiki bars in California, and maybe one thing about them that makes them special, that makes them stand out. What about the Tonga Room at the Fairmont?
Well, Tonga Room's absolutely iconic, 1960s. I mean, it's been in various guises for many years, but it was actually, it went full tiki in about 1967. And one of the fun things is that it's built around what used to be the hotel's pool at the Fairmont. So when you come in, you'll see this giant lagoon in the middle of the restaurant, but don't jump in, they'll throw you out. But what's super fun is that this band comes out on a floating bandstand into the middle of the pool and plays. And then every hour there's a rainstorm as a giant water falls into the pool from the ceiling from about 25 feet up. So that's been a iconic California destination for years. In fact, my late father-in-law even once saw Tony Bennett sing on the floating boat in there once.
Wow. That's amazing.
Can't beat
that's
that.
Cool. How about a few others?
If you're in Northern California as well, you don't want to miss Trader Vic's, which is an iconic destination, home of the original Mai Tai. Beautiful setting out on the Emeryville Marina. Great place to catch a sunset with some fried snacks and a nice cold Mai Tai. You've got Dr. Funk, new place in downtown San Jose, right in the heart of the kind of nightlife and entertainment district. Beautiful interior designed by my go-to designer, Ignacio Gonzalez, a.k.a. Notch. With some spectacular drinks. Contiki over in Oakland, a great little spot with really good beverage program and tasty bites. They've got a smash burger that's to die for.
What about Southern California?
In Southern California, the can't miss destination is the Tiki Tea, and out where Hollywood meets Sunset. It's been there since 1961, opened by the original one of Don Beach's original bartenders. Go in and try their house famous drink, the Ray's Mistake, which is a delicious treat. The Tonga Hut, that's LA's oldest tiki bar, opened in 1958. They have a terrific rum club and lots of regulars, and you can join the Loyal Order of the Drooling Bastard. It's hard to explain, but when you go there, look for the Drooling Bastard. You'll find him. The beautiful Royal Hawaiian in Laguna Beach opened in 1948 and has a brand new interior also by Notch. Strongwater in Anaheim, a newer place that is beautiful inside, has a great backstory about, and they make beautiful custom mugs there. One of my favorite food programs as well, Tasty Eats.
You know, Martin, a lot of these bars have been around for decades. What is it about kind of taking that trip back in time when you visit a tiki bar?
Well, the beauty of a great tiki bar is that it's a kind of a timeless experience. And we lost so many of them over the years, but the ones who survived, you know, there's a reason they survived. They were important parts of their community, wonderful legacy businesses that have made it through thick and thin. And, you know, they're all the more special because there's so few original survivors left. They're kind of the touchstones, the guidelines, you know, to, you know, how it used to look or how it used to be.
Right. So it kind of faded in popularity, you're saying, like in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. And then it came back. So what brought it back?
Well, what brought it back was it started really in earnest in the 90s. Back then, you'd go to a thrift store and you'd find an old mug. And you'd look at it and you'd say, what's this? And you'd look on the bottom and it would say, you know, the Islander, Los Angeles. And you'd say, oh, where's that? You'd go find, you'd look up this address of this place and you'd drive out all excited. Oh, what's this cool place? And, you know, then it's a typically become a Walgreens or a TGI Fridays or something.
Right, right. And just to be clear about the mug you're talking about, a lot of these bars, they would serve their drinks in these kind of very artistic looking mugs that might be, you know, an animal or, you know, like describe what that's all about.
Well, that trend starts around the 1950s. The mugs served a couple of great purposes. The mugs would be a great drink presentation. You'd get the drink and it looks amazing and it's got garnish coming out of it and everything else. It also has the added benefit of when you make a really good quality vintage tropical cocktail, you know, you're using a kind of a blend of rums and interesting syrups and bitters and all these things to come together. And so what you get are these great flavor sensations, but not always the best visual sensation. A lot of time these drinks kind of look like, you know, puddle water. So you put them in a mug and bingo, you've kind of hidden the color of the drink. So the mugs serve that purpose. They make this great experience. And then the tradition was always that you paid for it in the mug and you took the mug home. So the mug became a souvenir of your visit, as well as a handy source of advertising for the restaurant.
Right, right. I'm sure like they've also probably become like really great collector's items too. Like
crazy valuable now.
With tiki becoming so trendy, I mean, you were a major force in kind of making it trendy again. How did you first discover the tiki lifestyle and what about it appealed to you?
Yeah, so I got into it by my first tiki bar was a spot sadly long gone, but I was living and working in Washington, D.C., and there was a Trader Vic's at the Hilton. I had a coworker who said, let's go for my birthday. Let's go for drinks at Trader Vic's. And I said, what the heck is a Trader Vic's? And he said, oh, you're going to love it. The drinks are as big as your head. So we went and it was an absolute, it was just one of those moments that just changed my life. It was cold, drizzly November night and it was dark and depressing out there. And we go into this big, very staid kind of marble edifice of a hotel. And you take the stairs down to the basement and it's all just very austere. But then in one corner, there's just this doorway and it says Trader Vic's over it. And there's some torches out front and you walk in and it's this portal into another world. It's not the suddenly all the marble is gone, all the sort of hotel stiffness is gone. And you're in this place filled with beautiful art and carvings and natural materials and puffer fish hanging from the ceiling and big glass fishnet floats, and it smells like gardenias, and there's soft music playing, and there's some water feature in the corner burbling away. And it absolutely floored me. And that was 1995. I came back, I moved back to California where I was from, and eventually I decided to make my passion my profession and first started bartending at Trader Vic's in 2005, and then opened up my first tiki bar, which is called Forbidden Island, over in Alameda, California. A few other tiki bars had opened, but a lot of them didn't really take the drinks very seriously. They thought it was kind of campy. They treated the experience a little bit more ironically, but we treated it very seriously. And so we took not just the art and the design very seriously, but we took the drink making seriously. So there was a kind of a confluence of events, because in 2006, it was also the rise of growth of the craft cocktail movement was happening at the same time.
Martin, I wanted to get into your bar, Smuggler's Cove, for a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, can you describe what I'd experience walking in, you know, beyond just great cocktails? I mean, did you comb the beaches like Don Beachcomber did to find decor?
In a way, yeah. I mean, not that the beaches are full of good stuff anymore, but I did do a lot of shopping at some of the terrific maritime salvage places that used to be around San Pedro. And so I did find a lot of great old nautical ephemera to put up, lots of fish nets and cork floats and things from some old stuff from World War II. But we also found a lot of pieces from tiki bars that are shuttered. Some of the original Trader Vic San Francisco art, Don the Beachcomber Santa Clara, Trader Vic Chicago. So collected a lot of key vintage pieces. And then the other idea was We really put a bigger emphasis on rum at Smuggler's Cove. I mean, every good tiki bar has to have a great rum selection and a thoughtfully curated one, because you just can't make these drinks without not just great rums, but great blends of rum. We wanted that, but I also wanted to do more in our menu. I wanted to tell a broader story. Today, the great heyday of tiki, you know, being about those 30 years from the 30s to the 60s, but rum's a 3-century-old spirit. So I really wanted to have drinks that actually encompassed broader history, historic rum drinks, modern rum mixology, Caribbean rum mixology. How do people in Jamaica actually drink Jamaican rum? You know, they don't make tiki drinks. So I wanted to tell a broader story. And in doing so, we now have the largest rum selection in North America with over 1,300 different expressions.
Right, right, right. And amazing drinks. I mean, one of the awards that you've won was the James Beard Award, right, for your beverage book, Smuggler's Cove, Exotic Cocktails, Rum, and the Cult of Tiki. So that's pretty amazing. Let's talk, though, about the drinks a little bit more, especially for people who aren't familiar with tiki cocktails. So what is a classic tiki drink for people who have never been to a tiki bar?
The classic is really that tropical drinks are all based on punch. Punch is the kind of the format, and the format is there's a Caribbean rhyme which really encapsulates the structure really well. So it's one of sour, two of sweet, three of strong, four of weak. Your sour is some fresh citrus. Your sweet is some sugar, basically. Your strong is your booze, of course. Your weak is going to be your other juices, your mixers, ice cubes, whatever else. So the idea was to take this drink, a really nicely balanced drink, and then what Don Beach did, he'd mix in something that was absolutely in common use throughout the Caribbean in drinking, but not in the United States, and that's baking spices, allspice, clove, cinnamon, nutmeg. Putting these things in the cocktails gave them a kind of a depth of character and richness. And so it didn't just taste like fruit juice and rum. It had layers that would evolve as you drank it, that they would seem not just like a more complicated and interesting drink, and it's certainly not complicated just for the sake of being complicated, but complicated to derive and create a really unique taste sensation.
You know, before we move on from kind of the drink aspect of tiki culture, what's your go-to tiki drink and why?
Oh, boy. I usually come in and I like to get a Jet Pilot is one of my favorites. That's fresh lime and grapefruit and some allspice and falernum, which is a Barbadian liqueur. That wonderful kind of sharpness of fresh grapefruit alongside the lime, with some rich baking spice in the middle and a nice wallop of really good characterful rums.
What about for people who don't drink alcohol? Is there a tiki mocktail scene?
Tons. Lots of places have well thought out non-alcoholic options. It's one of the great things because you're not just, you know, at a regular bar, maybe you've got some, you know, some ginger ale handy or something like that. But at a, you know, at a tiki bar, you've got a lot of good non-alcohol ingredients, interesting syrups, fun spices. So you can make a really satisfying drink. At Smuggler's Cove, we do it. We do our NA drinks totally bespoke to order for our guests. They come in, they say, what do you have non-alcoholic? We say, what are some of your favorite flavors? Let's make something for you right now that you're going to love. You like coconut? Do you like passion fruit? Do you like ginger? What do you like?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the little umbrellas, the plastic figurines, the garnishes. I mean, there's just something that's just fun about a tiki drink.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's funny when a big group would come in and six people and five of them get a big drink and a 22-ounce snifter, and this big goblin has got flowers and mint and swizzles. And that sixth guy, he just gets a beer, and they all sit down together. And you see the guy with the beer kind of look at everyone else's drinks and go, man, I'm missing out.
Absolutely. Where do you see, before we go, like, where do you see tiki culture heading in the future?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's a good question. I would have thought, to be honest, that we were pretty saturated in terms of, you know, I've always thought of having a great tiki bar as a, like any community having a great sports bar. It's just something that, you know, it's a proud American tradition. There should be an offer on every, in every mid to large size market. And I kind of thought at one point that we were pretty saturated, but, you know, there's been four new tiki bars in 3 years just in the San Francisco Bay Area. they're not meeting, you know, they're not opening to empty houses. They're meeting an interest.
Well, Martin, this has been so much fun. I definitely want to try a tiki cocktail right now.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for joining us on California Now.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Martin Cade is the owner of Smuggler's Cove, a tiki bar in San Francisco, as well as several tiki-themed bars across the Golden State and beyond. To learn more about Martin's bars and cocktails, visit MartinCate, that's CATE.com. This is California Now. Thank you for listening to California Now. Whether you're an up-for-anything explorer, a checklist-loving director, or a hands-on artist, fun awaits you in the Golden State. Come play with us here in the ultimate playground. You can even have a little California fun before you get here. Head over to visitcalifornia.com/ultimate-playground and take a short quiz to unlock your California play style. You'll get custom vacation inspiration for your next trip to the Golden State. This podcast is produced by Visit California. I'm your host, Sotirios Johnson. Our producer is Kate Eppelboim. Jessica Marshall is our technical lead. John Godfrey is our editorial director. And the theme song is by Aaron Taus. Additional music by Casey. You can find our show on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.